Now we got a short ways into Joshua chapter 17 the last time we met, and we'll start close to the beginning of it this week. First of all, though, I want to step back. I want to look at some things from a broader perspective. Last time in chapters 15, 16, and a little bit of 17, we studied the all-important distribution of the promised land by Joshua to the tribes of Israel. Now, it's difficult to overstate the theological and prophetic significance of that particular event. It is at least on par with the return of Israel as a nation of Hebrews to its original homeland in 1948. A prophecy that was so long in the making that most Christians and Jews, by the way, had long ago given up hope of it ever occurring. In lieu of believing the scriptures and waiting on the Lord to move, to bring Israel home, some Christians devised what is called a replacement theology, whereby every biblical reference to the land and the people of Israel was allegorized into the church, essentially transferring the covenant blessings to Christians, but leaving all the covenant curses to the Jews. And the Jews decided that God had permanently exiled them from the promised land and they had no hope of return. Now, theologically, this land distribution in the book of Joshua is about God establishing his set-apart people in his designated set-apart place. It was about God's set-apart leader, Joshua, behaving as a godly leader should. He obeyed the Torah. He demanded that Israel also be obedient to the law. And he led the people selflessly as a servant, not a tyrant, not a prima donna. This also reflects God's character and his ability to do whatever it is he promised to do, even if it seems humanly and rationally impossible. I told you last time that there is an element of this land distribution that rarely, if ever, is taught and discussed. It is the element of responsibility and obligation to the inheritors of the land to the divine giver. And when Israel was looking ahead to that time that they would finally enter Canaan, and each tribe and each clan and each family received a piece of land for its own, they were all anxious for it to happen, the way a child looks forward to his upcoming birthday party. What they didn't realize was that connected with that inheritance of the land was an obligation to finish conquering it. Now, up to now, the 12 tribes worked together as a formidable army to battle the Canaanites in order to take their land from them. The holy war against Canaan had been largely successful, but much remained to be done. Not all the territory was conquered. It was spotty. I think the best way to look at it, to picture it, is to think of modern-day Afghanistan, in which there is no doubt that in general, the USA has conquered it, yet are we in full control of that nation? No, not even close. One city can be completely peaceful and just a few miles away, another one can be in utter turmoil. One city can be loyal to the new Afghan-US coalition government, another not far away is under the control of a warlord who opposes the government. This is how it was in Canaan, as we read Joshua 17. At the time of Joshua 17, the army of Israel had more or less disbanded, and each tribe now fielded its own separate militia. Each tribe was primarily concerned for its own interests, its own self. And as we'll find in this in the next chapter of Joshua as well, seven tribes had yet to receive their land inheritance. But it wasn't because it was not offered to them. It was. It was because they had refused to accept it. Why on earth would they do such a thing? Refuse to accept it. Because acceptance of their land inheritance meant that each tribe now assumed full responsibility to finish conquering it and then to govern their allotted territory. Inheritance neither meant peace nor stability for Israel. It was but a step along the way of a very long process that suddenly added a new and very challenging obligation. This was the historical reality of it, but it was and is also the theological reality of it. I've long argued against the modern complacent church doctrine that to its core believes that once a person walks the aisle and accepts their redemption from Messiah, that their work is done. We can all pull up a pew and just be interested observers from here on. And that by inheriting salvation, we can now just sit back and enjoy all the fruits, waiting only for the day we arrive in heaven. We pray, and then we just go our merry ways. Nothing could be less scriptural than that kind of a proposition. Instead, we are meant to equate our redemption, our inheritance, to that of Israel's over Canaan. That's one of the reasons the Lord chose to preserve this episode in Joshua for us, I'm convinced. Along with our salvation and inheritance comes duties and responsibilities. We have indeed come into some kind of a spiritual rest due to our trust in God's Son, but physically, we still live in a hostile, unconquered place. God stated over and over to Joshua that he had already accomplished victory over Israel's Canaanite enemies before the army even went into battle. Yet that did not somehow absolve Israel from participating in the battle and getting their hands dirty. God was not going to do a 100% supernatural Sodom and Gomorrah type of destruction upon Israel's enemies. Israel would have to fight. They'd have to fight for a long time to achieve victory and then to hold on to the gains they made. That path would be very uneven. It would be dangerous. It's exactly the same for believers in this or in any era. Now, I've said to you recently that Armageddon the church talks about, it seems like ceaselessly, is actually but the final battle for Canaan that starts with Joshua. Now, I don't mean that as an illustration or as allegory, rather as simple biblical fact. Fittingly, the name of the leader of the Battle of Armageddon, Yehoshua, abbreviated to Yeshua, is the same name as the leader for the Battle of Canaan, Yehoshua, but we say Joshua. The battle, of course, takes place in the heartland of Canaan and Armageddon, just as it did with Joshua. And although I'm not going to go into all the details right now, even observance of the all-important laws of Harem, the divine laws of holy war that God enjoined upon Joshua and Israel, are scrupulously observed at Armageddon, as all enemy combatants must be killed without exception because they are devoted to God as ban, as essentially spoils of war. But also consider the matter of the nature of the enemy. In Joshua's day, the enemy was the Canaanites, who were being ordered exterminated or in some cases kicked out because God judged them as being irreconcilably wicked in his eyes. Yet whom, spiritually speaking, was the prince over the wicked Canaanites? It was Satan. Therefore, at Armageddon, even though physically Yahushua, Jesus, will be leading holy war against the wicked people of the world from all of its many nations, spiritually, he is actually also fighting against the evil one, Satan. You see, just as Satan was the spiritual prince of Canaan, so now, as then really, he's also the spiritual prince of the entire world. Now, listen to me, please, because what I'm about to say in many ways even addresses the modern-day political arguments concerning Israel and the Middle East. Satan today has a legal right to this earth. God has legally turned it over to Satan for a time. God has the right to do this because God created and owns all things. The Lord, for his own good reasons, has turned the world over to Satan and pronounced him prince of the world. Satan is not a squatter. But he is in charge only for a while. He has limited power. He has limited scope. And his evil intents are being used to achieve God's will. Yet in the midst of all this, the Lord has made a path of escape for anyone who wants it. That path is called salvation. And recognize that though it's a spiritual, not a physical, path that results in spiritual, not physical repercussions at this point in history. See, Israel was redeemed, but they still had to deal with Satan and his followers. In line with that, we must also never think of the many different Canaanite tribes and peoples that lived in Canaan in Joshua's day as illegal squatters who thus deserved to have their fields and homes and cities taken from them. They had every legal right to that place until God decided it was time for them to be destroyed, and then the inheritors of that land, Israel, were to assume their rightful position. God had every right to destroy the Canaanites because they were evil in his sight, and so he judged them to destruction for their sin. God has every right to destroy Satan because Satan is evil. And so the Lord will eventually cause his destruction for his sin. See, Canaan was a type and a shadow of Satan, and of the battle of Canaan is a type and a shadow of the battle of Armageddon. In the book of Joshua, we are witnessing a type of battle of the battle of Armageddon that was not fully successful because God's people were disobedient and because their leader, Joshua, was imperfect. So here's what we can take from all this. First of all, Satan is currently the legal prince of the world, and he is ruling at God's will. Second of all, the day has already been appointed that the Lord will revoke Satan's position as prince and replace him with Yeshua. Third, God has determined that while non-Hebrews at one time had every legal right to the land of Canaan, now called Israel, they no longer have that right because he has turned that land over to his set-apart people. Fourth, as inheritors of God's kingdom, we indeed do have heavenly rest, but we do not yet have physical, fleshly rest. Fifth, as inheritors of God's kingdom, we have earthly responsibilities and duties to fulfill. Our lives are going to be full of conflict against evil. We must stand against it. We have to take action against it, and we have to be willing to be in harm's way in that process. Sixth, compromise is not an option. Compromise is not an option for us. But that's what the world wants. Joshua and the Israelites who would come after him compromised. And they made peace with the enemy. They allowed the enemy to survive. They allowed the enemy to prosper, to continue on in their pagan ways, provided they didn't bother Israel too much. But that was not what the Lord instructed Joshua and Israel to do. Christianity has for some time sought to compromise and to make nice with the world. That approach weakened Israel. And it's ruined, and it just ruined their harmony with Yahweh. And it has done exactly the same thing to the church. Let's reread Joshua chapter 17. Open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 17. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is on page 259. This was the territory chosen by Lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. As for Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilad, because he was a warrior, he got Gilad and Bashan. So the lot was drawn for the other descendants of Manasseh according to their families, for the descendants of Aviezer, Helech, Asriel, Shechem, Hefer, and Shemidah. These were the male descendants of Manasseh according to their families. But Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, only daughters. These are the names of his daughters: Machla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they approached Eleazar the Kohen, the high priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the leaders, and they said, Adonai ordered Moses to give us an inheritance together with our kinsmen. Therefore, in keeping with Adonai's order, he gave them an inheritance together with the kinsmen of their father. Thus, 10 parts fell to Manasseh, in addition to the land of Gilead, and Bashan beyond the Jordan, because the daughters of Manasseh had an inheritance along with his descendants, but the land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the descendants of Manasseh. The border of Manasseh began at Asher, and went to Mikmtat, which is across from Shechem. Next, the border went along to the right to the people of Ein Tapuach. The land of Tapuach belonged to Manasseh, but Tapuach on the border of Manasseh belonged to the descendants of Ephraim. The border descended to Wadi Kana, south of the Wadi, by cities which belonged to Ephraim among the cities of Manasseh, but the border with Manasseh on the north side on the Wadi, and it ended at the sea. Southward it was Ephraim's, northward it was Manasseh's, and the sea was its border, while to the north they extended to Asher and to the east to Issachar. In Asher and Issachar, Manasseh had Bet-Shan and its villages, Yivle-Am and its villages, and the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, of Ein-Dor and its villages, of Ta'anach and its villages, and of Megiddo and its villages, 3 districts in all. But the descendants of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities. The Canaanites wanted to stay in that land. And after the people of Israel had become strong, they made the Canaanites do heavy labor, but didn't completely drive them out. Then the descendants of Joseph spoke to Joshua, and they said, "Why have you given me only one lot, only one portion to inherit? After all, I'm a great people, since Adonai has blessed me so." And Joshua answered them, "If you're a great people, then go up to the forest and clear land for yourself there in the territory of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hills of Ephraim don't give you enough space." The descendants of Joseph replied, "Well, the hills won't be enough for us. And all the Canaanites living in the valleys have iron chariots, both those in Beit Shan and its villages and those in the Jezreel Valley." Then Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to both Ephraim and Manasseh, "You are a great people with much power. You will not have only one lot, but the hills will be yours too. Although it is a forest, you'll clear it, and the resulting open land will be yours. You will drive out the Canaanites, even though they have iron chariots and they're strong." Verse 1, and we discussed this at length last time, remembers that Manasseh and not Ephraim was Joseph's firstborn son. What it expects us to know, already know, is that Joseph's grandfather, rather father, Jacob, pronounced a divine prophetic blessing upon Joseph's two Egyptian-born sons that effectively took Manasseh's firstborn status away from him and turned it over to his younger brother, Ephraim, and simultaneously, Jacob adopted his two grandchildren and made them as his sons. Now, here it's necessary to have a firm grasp on tribal structure. First and foremost, it is that a tribe is composed of several clans, each of which is essentially a large extended family. Machir was the firstborn son of Manasseh, thus he represents the most prominent family. Understand, we are not talking about the actual person of Machir in these passages of Joshua, because Machir was long ago dead and gone. Rather, Machir is the name of the clan that he fathered, the clan of Machir. Okay. And of course, since the firstborn son of the tribe's founder fostered this particular clan, it is the most powerful of the several clans that together form the tribe of Manasseh. Now here we're reminded that the clan of Machir, which currently was under the leadership of Gilad, had inherited a territory on the eastern side of the Jordan River. And that territory was the land of Bashan, and a land that would be named after Gilad, that we in English say Gilead. Therefore, we are introduced to five other clans of Manasseh who were also to receive land, but their land would now be on the west side of the Jordan River, inside the Promised Land. These five clans would be Aviezer, Helek, Asriel, Shechem, and Shemidah. Now there is a sixth name mentioned, Hefer, and it comes with an explanation. Hefer was indeed a clan of Manasseh. In fact, he was the founder of a clan that had been spawned by another clan, Machir. In other words, of the sons and families that Machir had created, Hefer was one of the family lines of descent that had finally grown large and powerful enough to be considered a separate clan in its own right. This is not unusual. This is how the number of clans tend to grow within a tribe. The current male leader of the Hefer clan was a person named Zolofchad. This was Hefer's son. But there's a problem. Zolofchad had no sons. He only had daughters. Therefore, he had no son to carry on the clan authority when Zolofchad died. And further, since it was apparently quite rare that a man would have had no son to succeed him, I mean, that one of the purposes of a man having concubines was to be certain he would have a male child for an heir. It was therefore not a straightforward process to leave his wealth and possessions to his female children. So here we are reminded that the daughters of Zolofchad petitioned Moses when they were still out in the wilderness for Moses to declare that they, as women, would get a land inheritance inside the Promised Land. Otherwise, theoretically, the land inheritance that their father, Zolofchad, would have been entitled to would have been forfeited. Contrary to some beliefs, there actually is a provision in the law of Moses for females to inherit, not just males. So when Moses agreed to allow it, it was not an exception to the rule. Turn your Bibles to Numbers chapter 27. Numbers chapter 27, rather. Numbers chapter 27. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, that would be page 183. Numbers chapter 27. We're just going to read the first 8 verses. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, approached. These were the names of his daughters: Machla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood in front of Moses, Eleazar the priest, the leaders, and the whole community at the entrance to the tent of meeting, and said, "Our father died out in the desert. He wasn't part of the group who assembled themselves to rebel against Adonai and Korah's group, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be eliminated from his family just because he didn't have a son? Give us property to possess along with the brothers of our father." Moses brought their cause before Adonai, and Adonai answered Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right in what they say. You must give them property to be inherited along with that of their father's brothers. Have what their father would have inherited passed to them. Moreover, say to the people of Israel, if a man dies and does not have a son, you are to have his inheritance pass to his daughter." So this was a law. Here we see the story of Zelophehad's daughters developed some years earlier, and we see the Lord actually ordain a law that if a man does not have a son, he's obligated to give his inheritance to his daughters. Essentially, we find that it was this particular incident that prompted the creation of the law of female inheritance as just standard for Hebrew society. And since there were 5 daughters that each were to get land, there were 5 sons named in the preceding verses that would also inherit. Therefore, it was the tribe of Manasseh's allotment of land divided into 10 portions, as it says to begin verse 5, one each for the 5 females, one each for the 5 males. And again, we're told that this was in addition to the land that was granted to another clan that was located on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Well, beginning in verse 7, we get the boundaries and the borders for the tribe of Manasseh. Now, it was quite a large territory, and it was contiguous to Ephraim's territory, because in previous chapters we found that the procedure was that when lots were being drawn by Joshua to match up a region, a piece of land, to a tribe, and this would be according to the size, the population of a tribe, that only one lot had been drawn for the combined groups of Ephraim and Manasseh, and this was because they were considered to be the tribe of Joseph. And we're going to see shortly that, as confusing as all that can be to us, it was equally frustrating to both Ephraim and Manasseh, who, each being large, powerful tribes in their own right, had no interest in being lumped together as one with the common name of Joseph. Well, verse 11 gives us some controversial information, because in some ways it sounds like scribal error, maybe even double talk. Says that Manasseh was given cities within the tribal territories of Asher and Issachar. Now, on the surface, that's a problem. How could one tribe have cities in the territory of another tribe? That's like saying Florida has a city in Georgia, or another one in South Carolina. Obviously, there's a meaning to this that's not clear, and there's a couple of primary trains of thought about it. The first is that Asher and Issachar were actually the names of small regions This was not referring to their tribal territories. That, I believe, is a severe stretch. There's no evidence that two such small regions ever existed. It's just speculation trying to find a solution to the problem. Much more likely is that this passage means exactly what it says, that inside the original territories of Asher and Issachar, Manasseh held some cities. Now, we need to understand something. At this point, the divvying up of the territory to the Israelites was anything but clean and neat. It was a long and protracted process, because the Bible moves along at a very rapid pace. Reading from one paragraph to the next can move us forward by a decade or more. Turning a page, going to a new chapter, can advance us scores of years. Therefore, often only the barest of facts are given, or the final outcomes are recorded, and in the shortest, most general form possible. The reality is that tribal boundaries were constantly disputed. Some tribes didn't like the land they received, and so they easily gave some of it up, and they tried to acquire some other and different land. Some tribes got up and just moved entirely. And in other cases, boundaries expanded, or maybe they contracted for various reasons. This went on for hundreds of years, and the details of it are not recorded for us. Again, think of Afghanistan. You know, we can look at a map, we can see a simple outline, map of the country, and from a wide perspective, we've conquered it. But from a battlefield perspective, within a simple map outline, there's cities and there's areas that the USA and Central Afghan government controls, cities and areas they just don't. So from an overall perspective, an Israelite tribe was given a territory with some rough boundaries that essentially outlined that territory in a pretty general way. But inside that outline, there were cities they controlled but didn't occupy, cities they lived in, and cities over which the enemy held firm control, and they were not about to easily give it up. So for whatever reason, Manasseh had taken control of some cities that were located in an area that would eventually be allotted to Asher and Issachar. Now note that it was some time after Manasseh had taken its inheritance before Asher and Issachar took theirs. So even though in time Asher and Issachar would have their own defined territories, there would be cities within their territories that Manasseh had conquered years earlier. And they had no interest in turning that over to the other tribes, even though technically these cities were within another tribe's territory. And so Manasseh continued to control these cities within the boundaries of a territory, but that territory had not been assigned to them. That's how it happened. Well, beginning in verse 14, we get a small taste of the countless, never-ending kinds of disputes that arose among these tribes of Israel over land allocation. The gist of it's this: Ephraim and Manasseh were not happy with the amount of land they had received, and they wanted more land. And note again the reference to the descendants of Joseph, doing the complaining. This is, of course, referring to the two Joseph tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, even though most Bibles will show that last half of verse 15 in quotes, meaning in English grammar, we're supposed to be reading the exact words of some individual. In fact, this is just Hebrew storytelling. The idea is that the leaders of Ephraim and Manasseh lodged a complaint with Joshua, or some rabbis say that this was a complaint coming just from Ephraim, that effectively communicated dissatisfaction with the land allotment process. That there's not just a little bit of downright arrogance in the tone of this. They felt that since they were Joseph's sons, they deserve special treatment. Joshua was too experienced. He was just too tough. to simply accept such nonsense from the Joseph tribe. So he suggested that since they think of themselves as being so great, so mighty, then why not just go up into the hill country that's all full of forest and use some of their vast labor force to clear the trees for fields, to take whatever additional land they would need from their Canaanite enemies, the Perizzites and the Rephaim. Besides, that's what they were supposed to do in the first place. In other words, Joshua says Ephraim and Manasseh should make the equivalent of another allotment for themselves by their own labors. But don't come here asking for Joshua to take some already won territory away from the other tribes and give it to them as a special gift. The two Joseph tribes back down a bit, although they whine that even if they cleared the hills of the trees, unless they got into additional land, it wasn't going to be enough land. And not only that, but the Canaanites living in the valley areas of the land they currently have allotted to them are just too powerful to get rooted out. These Canaanites have so-called iron chariots. That's the problem. Well, to be blunt about it, the Joseph tribes really weren't telling the truth. Taken together, they amount to fewer than about 58,000 men of military age. Now, although the last census taken indicated that Ephraim was 32,500 and Manasseh was 52,700, about half, at least half, of Manasseh's number had been given land on the east side of the Jordan River. So the other half of Manasseh, which is who's being dealt with in these verses, plus the entire tribe of Ephraim, when you put them together, they were smaller than Judah. Matter of fact, they were even smaller than Dan as of this point in history. The territory given to the sons of Joseph was quite large, at least as large as Judah's, and it would be considerably larger than Dan's. Further, the Jezreel Valley that they were given is some of the most fertile soil anywhere in the Middle East. It's a huge area with nutrient-rich black soil several feet deep. Truly, the area is so amazing in its fertility that if Ephraim and Manasseh took it, they could have fed all 12 tribes from its crops. But as you can also imagine, the Canaanites who lived there weren't particularly interested in giving it up. They knew what they had. Generally, their request was hollow. It was self-serving without any real merit. It's just indicative of ongoing efforts by tribes to constantly increase their influence and prestige while putting themselves out the least possible. Well, Joshua didn't budge. And in the last few verses of chapter 17, he reiterates that since they see themselves as so powerful and so mighty, then all they need to do is clear the hill country and there'll be plenty of open land for farming. And since they're so numerous and confident of their own greatness, it shouldn't be beyond them to defeat these Canaanites with their iron chariots. Now, before we move to chapter 18, I just want to talk about these iron chariots for a moment. First of all, these were not chariots made entirely of iron. They were mostly wood. It was tipped with iron at strategic points. But it did make them more durable, not so easy to destroy as their all-wood counterparts. Second, there was a disadvantage, you see, to adding this iron. The chariots became significantly heavier. The extra weight meant that the terrain on which they could operate was limited. Mud was near impossible to navigate. So we find chariots in general, iron chariots even more so, limited to operating in valleys and in plains. Rocky, hilly geography was a no-go for chariots. So two specific areas that are still well known to this day are mentioned as places where the Canaanites operated their chariots and therefore where Ephraim and Manasseh felt they had no chance at victory: Beth Shan and the Jezreel Valley. Now, some of you have been with me on a tour to the Jezreel Valley. We've also spent time at Beit Shan. These are relatively flat areas that would have easily allowed chariots to operate just as they were designed. Well, let's move on to Joshua chapter 18. Turn your Bibles now to Joshua chapter 18. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's on page 260. Joshua chapter 18. The entire community of the people of Israel assembled themselves together at Shiloh, and set up the tent of meeting there, and after the land had been subdued before them. There still remained among the people of Israel seven tribes that had not yet received their inheritance. Joshua said to the people of Israel, "How long will you delay going in to take possession of the land which Adonai, the God of your ancestors, has given to you? Appoint three men for each tribe. I will commission them. And they are to set out and go through the land and describe it according to their inheritance, and then they're to come back to me. They are to divide it into seven portions, with Judah remaining in its territory to the south, and the house of Joseph in their territory to the north. You will describe seven portions of land and bring the descriptions here to me, and then I'll cast lots for you here before Adonai our God. But the Levites have no share with you, because the office of priest to Adonai is their inheritance. And Gad and Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh have already received their inheritance beyond the Jordan to the east, which Moses, the servant of Adonai, gave to them." So the men got up and went, and Joshua gave them this commission as they left to describe the land. "Go, walk through the land, describe it, then come back to me, and I'll cast lots for you here before Adonai and Shiloh." The men went and passed through the land, surveying it by cities, dividing it into seven regions, writing the results on a scroll. And then they came to Joshua in the camp at Shiloh. And Joshua cast lots for them in Shiloh before Adonai, and there Joshua divided the land among the people of Israel according to their regions. The lot for the tribe of the descendants of Benjamin came up according to their families. The border of their territory chosen by lot was between the descendants of Judah and the descendants of Joseph. On the north side, their border began at the Jordan, went up alongside Jericho on the north, continued up through the hills westward, and arrived at the Beit Avon Desert. From there, the border passed on to Luz, on the south side of Luz, that is Beit El, and then the border went down to Atrot Adar by the hill on the south side of the lower Beit Horon. The border was delineated as turning at the western corner and heading southward from the hill located in front of Beit Horon in the south, and it ended at Kiryat Baal, that is Kiryat Yarim, a city that belonged to the descendants of Judah. This was the west side. On the south, the border extended westward from the most distant part of Kiryat Yarim, going out to the source of the Neftoach Spring. Then the border went down to the farthest part of the hill located in front of the Ben Hinnom Valley, north of the Rephaim Valley, south of the Jebusites, continued down to Ein Rogel, where it was drawn to the north. Then it went on to Ein Shemesh, continued to Gileot, which is across from Maale Adumim, and went down to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben. Passed along the Arabah, heading north, and went down to the Arabah. Then the border passed alongside Bet Hogla, heading north. The border ended at the north bay of the Dead Sea at the south end of the Jordan. This was the southern border. The Jordan was to be its border on the east side. This was the inheritance of the descendants of Benjamin, defined by its surrounding borders according to their families. The cities of the tribe of the descendants of Benjamin, according to their families, were Jericho, Beit Hogla, Emek Katzitz, Beit Araba, Tzamarayim, Beit El, Avim, Parah, Ophrah, Kafar Ha Amona, Ophni, and Geva, 12 cities together with their villages. Givon, Ramah, Beirot, Mitzpah, Kephra, Motzah, Rechem, Yerpiel, Yar Allah, Tselah, Eleph, and Yavusi, that is Jerusalem, Givat and Kiryat, 14 cities together with their villages. This is the inheritance of the descendants of Benjamin, according to their families. Okay. Up to this point, the center of operation for Joshua and for the Israelites was Gilgal. Gilgal would eventually fall into Benjamin's territory. There, the wilderness tabernacle had been erected. There at Gilgal, the priests dwelled and officiated over the sacrificial rituals, and they serviced the sacred tent. There, the Ark of the Covenant, presumably with the Shekinah glory accompanying it, resided. But now, for reasons not given, Shiloh, became the new sacral headquarters and thus the new seat of government. It's hard to know how much time passed between the end of chapter 17, the allotment of the land to the Joseph tribes, and the beginning of chapter 18. Probably a few years at the very least. Now, apparently, at least some of Joshua's army remained intact. Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah had some successes against pockets of Canaanites that hung onto cities within their territories. So the land was now under sufficient control to move the tent of meeting to another place that was much more central, convenient for all the 12 tribes of Israel. But I want you to notice something. Shiloh was located in Ephraim's territory. And no doubt the Joseph tribes lobbied hard to have the religious power center of Israel and their family's territory. Because although the site was central, there were many better and easier locations in the Shephelah or even in the low foothills. You see, Shiloh, is hill country. It's beautiful there, but it is rocky and craggy and not so easily accessible. Today, it's in what the enemies of Israel term the West Bank. In biblical terms, it's in Samaria. The very area that the tent was erected is still visible to this day. It's an amazing thing to see. The evidence of it is obvious. Even the holes bored in rock where the posts of the courtyard perimeter curtain were all set up, you can find these. Put your hand in the holes. Several of you have actually been with me to that spot. And it's really breathtaking to know you are standing where the tent of meeting and the Ark of the Covenant once stood. But all was not going well. As verse 2 explains without much editorializing, 7 of the 12 tribes had yet to receive their land inheritance. Then an exasperated and an aging Joshua lays out the challenge to these tribes, and he says to them, you know, how long are you going to resist doing what God has instructed you to do? In other words, Joshua had been trying to get these 7 tribes to accept their allotted territories and then go and subdue them. They didn't want to. We've discussed in prior lessons and today that the current generation of Israelites were more like Bedouins. I mean, this group that was there during Joshua's day were like Bedouins. They had no interest in trying to make land produce. They had no interest in fighting over territory. They just would wander around with their flocks and their herds from place to place, seeking out fresh pasture, good water, living in tents. They wanted to do everything to avoid conflict. Commitment was not in their vocabulary. Boundaries were meant to be crossed, not enforced. Permanently settling was not their goal. It did not fit with the lifestyle they had learned during their 40 years in the wilderness. But Joshua wasn't going to give up. The time was right, so he ordered that each of the 7 remaining landless tribes appoint 3 men who would go out, and together they would map the territory allotted to them, then come back and report to him. Thereafter, adjustments would be made to each tribe's location and size, and Joshua would die then, knowing he had finished the work God had assigned to him install the people of Israel into their promised land and divide it among them. And we'll continue with chapter 18 next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.